Wednesday, June the 9th, Brendan got up early for breakfast with the Prime Minister of Australia, Lord Menzies. He wanted particularly for him to meet Ed Clark, who is to be our new ambassador to Australia, the Senate willing, and Australia providing an agreement. Sir Robert and Lady Jackson were invited too, but I felt, in spite of Lady Jackson's presence, this was really a stag affair, so I stayed in bed. My first appointment of the day was to go to the Congressional Club. How many dozens, hundreds of times I've been there since 1937, especially to the Friday afternoon teas. Constituents in tow, listen to an ambassador, or maybe a cabinet member, or someone from the world of the theater. This time it was to see presented at the club a miniature of my own inaugural ball gown, worn on a 4-foot doll, placed in a beautiful Italian cabinet, to join the collection spanning 100 years of first ladies, from Mary Todd Lincoln to me. I was horrified when I saw later in the paper that it cost $1,500. It was made by John Moore out of material he had left over, and presented to the club by Ivan Perfumes, Baron W. Langer von Langendorf, the head of Ivan Perfumes, elderly, gracious, beaming, on hand for the presentation to represent his firm. With summer upon us, it was not a crowded affair, just about 150 of the club members present, Carrie Davis and Mrs. Kunkel meeting me at the front door. We went in to look at the dolls, lining the walls of the parlor, newly decorated, had sherry, and then went upstairs for the presentation, Mrs. Kunkel welcoming everybody. I made a few remarks of acceptance, and then unveiled the cabinet containing the replica of my inaugural gown, thanking the Baron, receiving yellow roses from him. And then after hugs and kisses, as I went down the aisle, seeing my old friends, and getting a can of sorghum from Ivo Sparkman, I was back in the car by 12:30. I joined Sir Robert and Lady Jackson and the Ed Clarks for lunch in the downstairs dining room. I do not trespass on the upstairs one very often, and this time there was a luncheon off the record that Lyndon was having for Hearst newspaper executives, William R. Hearst Jr., Conniff, Kingsbury Smith, two or three more, and Marianne Means. But it had to be a brief luncheon with me, getting everybody settled, just a bite, and then loving goodbyes to Barbara and her husband, because they'll be going back to England any day now. And I had to meet the ABC filming crew for a long afternoon of this endurance contest. This afternoon is different from the others. There will be no teleprompter. It's the Washington-Baltimore Parkway and New York Avenue, and then the George Washington Memorial entrance to the city of Washington, and then a drive through Rock Creek Park. If I were as aggressive as I am understanding, I would have insisted on reversing the order and doing Rock Creek Park first in order to assure myself and get me in the mood, because Rock Creek Park I know and love from more than 25 years of experience. In New York Avenue, for instance, I have no particular feeling for, therefore I cannot talk about it. I found it very different without a teleprompter. I sat in the back seat of the car with my friend Bill Hartigan, the cameraman, crouched up on the front seat, grinding away with his camera, and John Secondary slinking, if one can say he does, into the corner of the left-hand back seat, while I just simply talked away about the history of Rock Creek Park, for instance, how it was acquired, what it means to the city, for a flow of traffic, for beauty, for a ribbon of green. It was nearly 3 hours before we returned to the White House, with me feeling shaky and uncertain about the result, and it was time to get ready for the farewell party for the Kermit Gardens. Like others, it was in the Yellow Room at 6:30, small, intimate, perhaps the smallest of the lot. The honorees, the Kermit Gardens, their daughter Catherine, and the young man she's going to marry, the Dave Bells of AID, Celebrezes from the Cabinet, and the Fowlers and the Freemans, and the Grunowskis, and Lydia Katzenbach, and Dean and Virginia Rusk, bless them, the Kermit Gardens, Charles Schultz, Jew and Lee Udall, and Jane and Bill Wirtz, and Jim and Patsy Webb, whom I'm always regarded as very special friends, somehow having North Carolina connections, special credentials to me. This was one of those parties where you soon felt the waves of good communication flowing, everybody having fun, Jane Freeman and I and Orville reminiscing about what a wonderful snorkeling guide Noble Samuel is, Stu and Lee Udall adding their word about the glories of the Virgin Islands, the history of the park system there. I had a good chat with David Bell about Tony's working temporarily for AID, advising on how to market handicraft products made in some 6 South American countries. The hit of the evening was Mrs. Kermit Gordon, always so quiet and gentle and in the background, but it seems she just delivered a budget message of her own to her husband, that is a family one, at another farewell party, and everybody was hilarious over it. The universal language, wife to husband, budget message. In the midst of Lyndon's toast to the Kermit Gordons, I stood beside it, behind the desk, and then casually rested my knee on the green leather antique desk chair, my hands on its back, my full weight on it. Crash! Down it went to the floor. Lyndon, without even a comma, continued his speech and gets an A for poise, also for not being put out with me. One of the hazards of living with antiques. But thankfully, the next day I found out it could be mended by skillful craftsmen. Must have been a good party, because the guests stayed fully 2 hours. But then, Lyndon went back to his office, and I worked at my desk in some mail. It was nearly 10:30 before he came home for dinner, just the two of us. Reverberations are still coming in from Lucy's weekend in Milwaukee. That irrepressible child had worn a wig as a disguise. She'd rented it from Jean-Louis and had taken it to Marquette, where she'd gone to a prom, to graduation events, and a mass at a Catholic church, eluding happily the pursuing press and falling in love with Marquette. And from all I hear, they fell in love with her. I couldn't help but be a bit chagrined that after all my calling from faraway Virgin Islands to the Feldsteins, and their gracious welcome prepared at their house for her, that when she drove up in front of their house, saw a TV truck, lots of newspaper men with cameras, she just said, "Keep on driving." She didn't stop at all. She spent the night, it said, at the home of her former agent and his wife and family. But she told me she'd call the Feldsteins to apologize and to thank them.